Thank you for joining us for another episode of No Tippy Tappy Football, brought to you by William Hill. Hey, Sam.
Good morning.
You okay?
I'm very good, thank you. After a weekend of football, watching the ups and downs again, and a bit glad I'm not amongst the controversy that the referees are still causing, but there we go.
There is so much to talk about from the last couple of days of football, so we're very much going to get into that. I'm looking forward to it. I can't wait to get your opinion on so many things. Before we do, though, would you like to introduce our guest?
Pleasure, as always, to see my guest today. It's been a while since we've been face-to-face, but we worked together at Newcastle when I took over, and I was very pleased that he stayed on. Because he's a man of principle, like, and if he didn't think he could contribute, he would have left. But he decided to listen to me and my tactics and my way forward, and it was a pleasure to work with him at that short period. Unfortunately, it didn't last as long as we'd have liked. So it's a pleasure to welcome Nigel Pearson. Nigel,
how are you, Sam?
Thank you very much.
Good to see you, lad.
Thank you.
Great to see you.
Nigel, thank you so much for being
pleasure.
Here with us today.
Yeah.
Pleasure. Always like to start off. So Sam's given us a little tidbit there. How have your paths crossed in football over the years? What's your earliest memory of our Sam?
Well, I remember Sam really, I suppose, in management at Notts County. Mm. That's when I first came across him. But obviously, I knew him as a player. I also knew about his ventures to America, you know. So it's Sam's a person that he's got a I think his personality or the stories about him sort of precede him everywhere he goes, and I think it's really interesting. It was interesting for me to not only meet him but work alongside him as well, because I'd heard lots of things about how innovative he was at Bolton, and yeah, we were talking about it off air, about managers getting labelled, and I think what interested me more than anything was how much Sam was prepared to give people the opportunity to speak, I think about my own career, and I've managed for quite a while now, but I also have been assistant manager or a coach for somebody else. I've assisted lots of managers, and I think you pick up a skill set which is a little bit different, you know, if you're not leading from the front right from the start of your career, then you sort of pick up different ideas. And I think for me, that was a pretty good route, because I didn't know whether I was going to go into management myself, especially after about 7 or 8 years of being an assistant. But it is interesting when you work with different people to if you like, work out what you are yourself. So I suppose at other people's expense, you can learn lessons about how you might deal with things in your own way. So, yeah, I mean, Sam and I, we didn't work together for too long, but yeah. but when Sam got sacked at Newcastle, I do, and I was talking to one or two of the lads earlier about the conversation that we had on the phone. It was a very shortish conversation. And he said, I've been sacked, lad, and so I can't talk for long. And I'm not leaving here until they pay him up in full. And that's it made great. Me giggle. It made me giggle. But it's a story where, yeah, I can laugh about it, but it's an introduction into the harsh realities of management, and that is, you know, we all have a shelf life at a football club, and one of the most important things when you start off is to get the exit clause watertight. Simple. So I learned a lot of things off Sam, to be fair. Yeah.
And your last job, so Bristol City, yeah, back in October 2023, you left.
Yeah.
We always ask our listeners, our viewers, our subscribers, if they'd like to send in questions for our guests. And you can always do that on Instagram, Twitter, or YouTube. Quite a few asked this. And Tom wanted to know, what happened and why was your departure so out of the blue?
Ooh, that's a question that possibly I can't answer in some ways. But it was, okay, so why was it out of the blue? Their decision. I learnt afterwards, I didn't learn by any conversations I had with anybody at the football club, but I learnt afterwards that it was for results. And I also heard via some interview that was done that the squad was in danger of being deconditioned, which... was
what does that mean?
Well, look, all I'd say about that is I think the chairman could have just spoken to the technical director and he would have been able to give them the information that he needed, but ultimately they went public on the reasons, and I was not aware of that until I heard that in the interviews that were done. So it's just football.
Was that an excuse then in the end, you think, for the reason why it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter in the end, does it?
But
was that contract watertight, like you said, then in the end?
Yes.
Good.
Yes.
That's all that matters, which is why I probably won't say too much more. Yes. Yeah, confidentiality.
Absolutely.
Yeah. We all have to sign one when we get paid off.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, sadly. Yeah. So we can't really say what we want to say.
Are they confidentiality clauses for forever? Or do they have like a time span?
That's a good question.
Ask me in 12 months' time.
Yeah, I'd say, they might well have broke their confidentiality in the first place, because it's both ways. When you sign your agreement, you sign that you will not criticise the club, and they sign that they will not criticise you. And they are the ones that always break that contract first.
So if they break it, you can break it.
Absolutely. That's it then. It's done and dusted. So you get your lawyer to send them a letter tied by saying that we've seen in the press what you've written. It's the director of football, or it's the owner, or one of the directors. You have broken our agreement. Be careful. Don't do it again. But my client has the right to respond on anything now because you've broken this clause. So that's what you look out for straight away. Because that's what happens most of the time, like you mean. So they break the confidentiality. So it always works both ways when people say you can't do too much.
Yeah.
It's those who generally don't keep their mouth shut like they should. And that gives you the opportunity to respond and reply. And that's
you what, don't that's have to take the opportunity though, Sam.
No, you don't. No, you very much just get on with move on and get on with your life, like you
absolutely.
Mean. And leave it at that, like you mean. But it's always... It's always a good lawyer you need. And the LMA, as you well know, I almost talked about the LMA being under committee. The LMA on that front now are very, very, very good and rarely lose a case if they have to take a case up on your behalf. So it's a brilliant organisation and it's there for the desperate need for a manager and his family to be compensated the right way when they've probably sacked him, and most of the time they don't deserve it, but they are the scapegoat.
I love that. It random insight you won't get anywhere else. I love that. Nigel, you never know where things are going to go on this podcast,
I do ramble as well sometimes.
Wonderful.
We're going to be here for 3 hours, you know, today, Natalie, like you mean. So,
I've been warned, Sam. We're going to go down some right... weird roads today. We always like to know with our guests as well, how is life treating you right now? What are you doing? Are you looking to get back into management?
I'm concentrating very much on my health at the minute. I've had a problem with my back last year, and I've had a neurological problem, which has been a bit of a test for me. But I am slowly getting better, which is good. And I mean, look, there's lots of different ways of, it depends what people want, really, I suppose. I'm a manager. I'm a football manager.
Not a coach.
I can coach.
Yeah,
and
so can I.
And I do coach.
Yeah.
But I'm a football manager. And I'm not really a head coach. And I suppose while the fad at the moment seems to be let's get a younger coach, you know, I mean, there you go. Is football suffering with a bit of ageism as well, maybe? But, you know, I think the most important thing for me at the moment is just to make sure that, firstly, I spend enough time looking after myself to make sure that if an opportunity comes along that I want to take, that I'm ready for it. Because, you know, fitness is, yeah, very much a physical thing. And when you suffer with ill health, you know, it really is a bit of a not a wake-up call, but it reminds us all, I think, of what is the most important thing. So health is really, really important. And I need to make sure that I'm physically in good shape, but mentally that I'm ready for the next challenge. Because I'm sure there will be an opportunity at some point. And when that comes, I want to enjoy the challenge. You know, I want to be able to do the job well and be successful, whatever success is, because, you know, success is always judged, I think, by people, you know, trophies, who wins what. But the reality is that there are lots of successes out there. Success can be avoiding relegation. It can be, you know, cutting a wage bill and making sure that the club survives and remains sustainable. You know, there's lots of ways of framing what success is, and there's a very small number of people who head up a football club, whether they be a head coach or a manager, who will win things. But there are lots of successes out there, and there's lots of really good managers and really good coaches out there. So, you know, I'm always willing to take on something that is a little bit out of the ordinary, that's a challenge, because I get bored quite easily as well. You know, I'm not somebody who I'm not somebody who just wants to take an easy job on. You know, I like a challenge, and I like to be a part of a team of people who want to do something. So, yeah, it'll interest me, I think, the next job that I end up taking, if I take one, because I don't know what it's going to be, and I've got no idea what it looks like at the moment.
Oh, next time you take a job, I'll think about that. I wonder what the challenge or what the interest was there. In terms of your old clubs, do you keep an eye out on Bristol City? I mean,
of course I do. Yeah, of course I do. I really enjoyed living down there.
Yeah, nice area.
Yeah, it's Bristol, beautiful. Yeah. It, you know, and I bought some woodland down there. I've not been to for a while because I've not been able to do much stuff. But I really enjoyed living down there. I think I had a good connection with a lot of the people there as well. I still keep in contact with members of the training ground staff. You know, there's some really good people there. The fan base were very patient, knowledgeable. They were able to see past, I think. I mean, look, the results weren't always brilliant, but I think, you know, what they could see was a team that really wanted, that worked hard, trying to win games. Yeah, we weren't always at our best, but, you know, it was quite a complex job in terms of trying to change what the squad could do and look like. And, you know, people wanted people, I think, get bogged down with talking about styles of play. But I mean, ultimately, we tried to get the best out of the players that we had. And I think we developed a number of the players there. I mean, it's a good club in the sense of an academy which has a big catchment area, and they are, you know, I think the academy is good. I think the academy tries to develop players for the club. And of course, the circumstances that I was working in along with my staff was very much the case that we were fortunate that the club were producing some good players because we needed them. You know, when you have to reduce the wage bill and try and improve performance on the pitch, it's not necessarily a straightforward thing to do. So, you know, although it didn't end particularly in an amicable way, I think I would like to think that we as staff, all of us, and even that includes the people who remain there now, worked really hard to try and get the best out of what we had and develop what we had. So it certainly, you know, I think Liam took over the position and inherited a very decent situation, let's put it like that.
We're going to speak about a few of your other former clubs a little bit later. Yeah. But there's so many big talking points that have happened this weekend. So, Sam, we should just tell everybody that we're filming this Monday morning, right after the semi-final weekend, so Monday the 22nd of April. So that is when we're filming it, just so you know, in case anything changes in the next couple of days, this is when we are filming. So, first of all, yesterday Sunday, there was a lot going on. The first thing I want to talk about, though, is this Nottingham Forest situation, Sam. The tweet that they put out 5 minutes after the end of their game about the VAR, about the refereeing situation. What was your instant reaction?
Well, I've been listening to Talk Sport on the way in, which is, you know, sometimes very annoying, like Simon. You know what I mean? I mean, you know, his opinion and only an opinion matters in his eyes, like you mean. But look, and Jim kept explaining about they never asked him to be replaced because he's a Luton fan and the VAR and who's controlling VAR. So the bottom line is that the fact that is you cannot and you will not really get anywhere with the controversy that's been created because they're so protected. Ultimately protected, and you get fed up of paying 10 grand, 15 grand, or 20 grand when you actually speak the truth.
Oh, is that a fine?
Yeah.
We're talking about the refs.
And if you go and present the evidence, right, which I have done many, many times, the best they'll do is let you off with a warning if you're lucky, but very rarely will they actually let you off. So it's biased from that point of view. So they protect the referees at all costs. You can prove and I've proven on many occasions, even by getting a linguist in to read lips to prove that the point of what the referee actually said to me or did, right? That's way, way back. But you do that. You get fed up of doing it, but you also get fed up of getting fined for being right because they protect you so much. Now, I was a VAR advocate. I wanted that.
Yeah, I know you were.
To reduce the number of times I were going to get fined by saying about what the referees did and did not do in that particular game and why they were unconscious bias lies with the referee a lot. Don't do it on purpose, but unconscious bias means that when they get the 75,000 at Man United, they won't give that penalty for you, but they'll give it for them. Absolutely, it's a fact. You know what I mean? So it's unconscious bias. They don't do it on purpose, but it happens. But what happens in the decisions of three possible penalties and not three not being given raises concern because in many people's eyes, everybody in across the country was saying at least one of those three was a penalty, but yet none of them have been, not one has been given. And that's where the controversy lies for me. That's where the letter is being sent and gone, what is happening to Stuart Atwell in that VAR situation? What is he doing? Why is he not helping the referee to make the right decision? And then you see the penalty given against Man United and you go, I've gone. Not a chance.
And not against City, to be fair, which was a very similar one on Saturday.
You know, so I'm going and looking at the situation and saying controversy around what's happening with referees again. And again, you know, I said I'm an admirer of Howard Webb. I was glad to see him come in, but he has got so much to deal with and he needs to be dealing with it on and behind closed doors, not on the TV screen with Michael Owen. Mm. Go and get your house in order.
Yeah.
Mm. You need to get your house in order like quickly because we're not seeing any improvement, in my opinion, and lots of people's opinion, by the referee is there and the VAR is to make sure the decisions are being given correctly. And unfortunately, too many of those decisions by all this team are being questioned. And then people are asking for the conversation, what went on, why did they do this, why didn't they do this? And I mean, you know, we look at, and rightly so, we look at the semi-final commentary. What an unbelievable game. I mean, what a game. I mean, you would feel sorry for Coventry this morning. I mean, I played for Coventry. What a great, great club it is. And they, on the whisk of an inch or two, won that game. And it was taken away from them, like you mean. So, but what a comeback. What a thrill. Brings up massive questions about Ten Hag and his tender at Manchester United again. And everybody's talking about, is he going to stay or isn't he? That's only come about by the new ownership that's taken over. If it wasn't any new ownership, they wouldn't be saying Ten Hag's definitely going to be there next year, you know. But because they have a new ownership who's looking after the football matters, who've got a lot to do, they're always, every day, the press are questioning, is Ten Hag going to stay? And the only people that can keep him in the job are the players between now and the end of the season. So the controversy is taken away this morning from the great football we've seen.
Mm.
Which was over the weekend. There's some great games, but the controversy this morning is all about what these decisions should and shouldn't be, what this was and wasn't. And instead of us talking about the great football we've got in this country, the best league in the world, we're talking about referees again. And I'm joining in like everybody else, like you mean. But it's a goddamn shame that we're not talking about the football rather than talking about the controversy.
Mm.
Did you make?
Well, a bit like Sam, and I suppose I talked about when I was at Newcastle. I've always been an advocate of technology in sport because it's there, I think, to help the referees, the officials make the right decision. That's the. But wow, we don't half complicate it, and I think that's the biggest problem. And it has to fall very much with the ability of the officials to interpret what they're seeing, and it questions whether they understand what they're looking at, and it's really quite straightforward because you look at other sports and whether it would be something tennis, technology,
rugby.
Rugby for me is the fact that you can hear what they're saying, you can hear the conversation, it's done in a way which is, it's quick, and they make decisive decisions. And that's VAR should be used in that way. It should be used to help them make the decision. It's not there for them to abdicate responsibility. At the end of the day, the man in the middle, or the lady in the middle, the woman in the middle, whoever it is who's officiating the game, still needs to be the person who makes the decision. with the aid of technology. We just make it into a farce, because what's given on one day isn't given the next. Right. And, you know, it's just an absolute shambles, basically, really.
So do you have sympathy with Nottingham Forest in terms of the statement that they released?
It doesn't matter whether I have sympathy with the sentiments of it, but I think it's another example, I suppose, of the pressures of social, you know, I mean, my last job, you have members of staff in the comms team who are responsible for the social media side of it, and I suppose, you know, they're like everybody else. If they're fans and they feel emotional about it, they might just put something out. You know, whether it represents what the club wants to say is a totally different thing.
You have to ask the club. If you're going to be controversial, you have to say to the club, "I'm going to be controversial."
Yeah, it must have been the owner.
You know what I mean? Well, the owner, yes. I mean, but that, then you're talking about what you consider to be unfair consistently. And I always have not had the opinion of lots of managers saying, if you keep on at them, they'll go against you. Right. I'm going, no, I'm going to keep on at them until they change.
I just find it worrying. I've said on this podcast before, the game doesn't exist without referees. No. So
anyway, for your point of view, I was at Real Madrid, Man City.
Oh, no. I
was completely and utterly bored watching the game, because I've never seen Real Madrid defend so well in my entire life, by the way. So I have to give a little bit of credit for Real Madrid, because I've never seen them defend like that. And Carlo Ancelotti really, unfortunately, sucked in Pep. And sadly, lost on penalties.
Sam! And it was freezing,
by the way, that night.
It was freezing.
I know. I took my grandson because it was his birthday, and I was so looking forward to the game. But I had to say that if you want to talk about somebody spoiling a game, it takes two to tango, doesn't it? And that was exactly what happened, that Roma didn't tango on the night but got the result.
What did you make of the City's game at the weekend and the FA Cup semi-finals?
They were lucky to win it. And I've got every sympathy for Pep. Again, this is ridiculous. I agree with him 100%. Is who's in control? Who made that decision? I believe, as Gary Lineker said, it probably was the TV saying, we want this game on Saturday.
Or the police.
No, there's no difference at Wembley whether it's Saturday or Sunday.
I agree. Apparently, though, they labelled Coventry Man United a high-risk game.
So what's the difference with having it on Saturday or Sunday?
I don't know.
Look, you've got to look at the welfare of the players and what they're going through. I mean, there's no need for Man City to play on Saturday. They all know when they've gone through extra time. Like, I mean, it's a disadvantage. You want a proper game. You want two teams to compete against each other on the fair playing field. It's an unfair playing field when Man City have had to go through extra time and penalties on Wednesday night and can be given... I mean, Chelsea must have been rubbing their hands saying we're playing on Saturday rather than Sunday. Mm. Because we all know the experience of having to... When I got Bolton into Europe, our experience of playing on Thursday and then getting the team to perform to the top level on Sunday was a massive task.
Mm. Yeah.
Massive. And that was without extra time and penalties. You know what I mean? So I sympathize, because a lot of people will go, oh, why is he moaning? Is the right to moan the fact that it could have easily been played? And Coventry and Man United have got nothing to complain about playing on Saturday, because neither of them had a game through the week. So, you know, I get where he's coming from. Mm. And luckily, he said it when he's won.
Yeah.
Because if he said it when he's lost, it was the old sour grapes, you know, he's moaning again, like, you know what I mean, and all that crap that goes on with it, you know what I mean? So, you know, you should listen to the managers. They're not speaking for the benefit of the football club and the players, particularly, because you have to protect your players at all costs today, because the criticism they get is just beyond belief these days.
I thought the irony, though, or the conversation coming up, given in a week where we've been talking about FA Cup replays and the reasons for FA Cup replays, too many games and that, and then we can't even schedule the fixtures. What did you make of the FA Cup replay situation?
I think it's a shame for smaller clubs, clubs that have made for non-league clubs to make it to the third round is a fantastic achievement. And then, you know, if you draw a big club and you get the opportunity for a replay, it's part and parcel of the competition. I think it's a shame. I think it favours. I know what we've just been talking there about schedules, and yeah, for sure that for the successful clubs, the clubs that are competing to win tournaments, then yeah, that it puts added pressure on them. But I mean,
that's what they're there for. Yeah, but we do it for the few big boys.
Yeah, yeah.
Rather than the whole Nigel, don't we? You know,
we've
already had to give up Saturday FA Cup games. You know, the tradition was that Saturday was sacrosanct for the FA Cup, and only on a Saturday was round 3, 4, 5, 6 to the final was a Saturday.
Yeah, yeah.
We've had to give that up now.
Yeah. They're bringing that pressure.
Are they?
Yeah, the weekend games only next season.
Well, that's absolutely right. Like, I mean, because when you're looking at the FA Cup and the tradition of the FA Cup, and believe you me, there's nothing more than I would have liked to win or even get to the final of the FA Cup. Like, I mean, got the Carling Cup, but not the FA Cup. But I've always had this remit from my owners. The Premier League's all what we want and all we need, Sam. I don't care about the cup. I don't care about... So I have to bear in mind that the most important thing for the football club and its survival is to stay in the Premier League and not worry too much about the FA Cup. Now, I'll take the stick, I'll carry the can when I end up putting out a team with 6 or 7 changes to... But I also say, before we start, that I'm making 6 or 7 changes because I have a squad and I want to see whether the squad of players can cope with playing in the first team in the FA Cup, whoever it is. Mm. So I've got rid of many a player that's moaned in my office and sat going, why am I not playing? And I put them in the game and they've gone, and the shit. Right? So I've got them in and go, find another club. Yeah, I'm sick of you coming and knocking on my door. You've had your chance. You're crap. So off you go. Get yourself, ring your agent up and get yourself sorted and get out.
Yeah.
And don't mess about, like, don't come hanging around here, like, because it won't be good for you. You know what I mean?
Did you tell him you've deselected yourself?
Deselected yourself, yes.
You deselected yourself.
You've had your chance. Now,
now you've deselected yourself.
Sometimes you only get one chance in life, in football
particularly.
And you, and you, that's the ruthless side of what you have to be. You can't pussyfoot around this.
No.
Because they'll end up taking the mickey out of you. They might end up costing you your job. You know what I mean? And that's what you've got to be ruthless when it comes to that. And that's what it's all about. But you know, FA Cup is sacred in my view. And I'm glad you've told me that it's coming back on a Saturday.
Yeah, they changed it to just weekends because I agree. When we had the first round game on a Wednesday night, it was weird. But oh gosh, I hope they change their mind. If enough clubs come out and say something, I hope they change their mind. At least for rounds 1 and 2. Well,
like Nigel said, the amount of money that a non-league club can get. Getting to round three,
can
keep him in business for 2 or 3 or 4 years. Like, I mean, what was his name who we had from Dorking?
Yeah, I was thinking about our friends from Dorking, Mark.
Mark, I mean, they're still struggling a bit.
It went down,
You know, but I'd like to see him in whatever round is next year, if he's listening, and I'll be there.
We're going, aren't we?
We'll go. Yes. You know what I mean? And we'll see what it's like down there. Like, I mean, because he's a character and a half, Nigel. I mean, he owns the club as well as manages it. You know what I mean? And he's got him from, I don't know what league down the bottom into the conference or whatever it's called now.
Took his chance while he was here to ask Sam to come and manage.
Yeah, he did. Yeah, it was really funny. It was and passionate and people like him deserve the recognition for what he's done for football in that area and how he's achieved it. Yeah. You know, it's brilliant. You know,
and people like him and those fans deserve a goddamn replay. If they draw with a league club, they deserve a replay.
They do. You're right there.
Yeah.
Right. That has been
agreed.
Good. Look at that.
We're off track again.
No, I love it when you go off track, Sam. You know I'm all good. Right, let's...
I'm confused.
I'm always confused on this podcast, Nigel.
Where are we going?
We're going to talk about some of your former
confused
clubs.
All right, okay. Week. No,
I love it. I love it. Sometimes I just look at my notes and go, right, where are we? A couple of your other former clubs. Mm-hmm. We'll talk about the Premier League, but let's talk about the Championship for a minute. Oh, my goodness. I love the Championship.
The Championship, I think, is the most underrated league in the world, possibly. And mostly by clubs who are in it, because they all want to get out, going upwards.
Whatever they
but
can.
It's not really possible for lots of them. But it is a very, very competitive league. Unfortunately, though, what I will say is, though, is the gap is getting, you know, the sides who went up last season, you know, in Sheffield United,
Burnley. And Luton.
And Luton, yeah, but Luton have probably
the best.
Made a good scrap of it because they've stayed true to what they are. And I think, you know, I think Burnley, Burnley just cruised it last year. They were brilliant. And yet, you know, you look at how tough it's been for all of the clubs, but certainly them and Sheffield United, they've really struggled to make it into a. You know, it's not a fair fight, if you like. So it's
and then they sacked the manager,
but
it's not his fault,
but
isn't it?
Yeah, but
it's not his fault. And they sack it. He gets them up with a shoestring budget. They sell the best players, and then they sack him because he's not getting results in the Premier League. Yeah. And you go, I wish I hadn't got you promoted.
Yeah.
I'd still be in a job if I were at the top of the Championship. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, he deserved the right to take Sheffield United down. Sorry, United, but then like Burnley, it looks like they're going to stick with him and then let him bring him up again next year, which is the right thing to do. But unfortunately, at Sheffield United, he's back on, he's on the scrap heap, looking to try and get another job again. Like I mean, and which is not really his particular fault, but what an achievement he did under that financial restriction, the quality of the players by getting them promoted in the first place.
Must say as well, lots of Leicester fans contacted us with nice things and to say thank you. And so lots of Leicester fans wanted us to send you their very best wishes. It was up for them. And then they had a right stumble. It's been up and down. It's kept them on their toes right to the end of the season, but they're looking like they're going to do it. We should tell everybody again, just to say that we are recording this before the Southampton game.
Which I will be at, actually.
Ah. Very good.
I'll be at that game. I'm doing some TV work for Sky, so I'll be there. I was there at the weekend as well. Always a pleasure to go back. And as
they seem
club,
to welcome you back, though, Nigel. They're good that way, aren't they? Yeah.
They're brilliant in terms of how, you know, the club show a lot of class. I saw Shaky. There as well, which was it was good to catch up with a number of people. Susan Whelan, the CEO, has done a fantastic job over the years, but also shows a lot of class and on behalf of the club. I've seen the club grow over a number of years. Obviously, I wasn't there, no longer at the club when they won the Premier League, but it was an incredible achievement.
Nigel's best signing ever, Jamie Vardy.
Jamie Vardy. I was going to ask you about the name.
Well, I
was offered him and at West Ham. Mickey Mellon was the manager. He rang me up and said, "Whatever you do, take Jamie Vardy." He said he'd be the best player you'll ever sign. I went to David Sullivan and he went, was it £1 million?
£1 million, yeah.
He said, I'm going to waste £1 million on a non-league player who might not make it, like you mean. And I'm going, well, you know, I've been highly recommended by Mickey Mellon. He used to be my player at Blackpool. Like, you know, I think we should risk it. Mm. I'd have to say it's a risk. Mm. But, you know,
Well, and in his first...
Incredible.
And in his first season, you know, he started really well, but then he had a difficult spell. But as I tried to explain to people at the time, your expectations as a manager when you sign a player from a lower league is they need time to adjust, acclimatize, get used to the different level of exposure and expectation. And so it's not only is it a big leap in terms of the quality, but the mental pressures are big as well. So, you know, I mean, he's been fabulous. But I reminded him at the weekend, actually. I said to him, you know, I still smile about it now. The year after I got sacked there, and obviously they went on to win the Premier League.
Yeah.
I was playing cricket for a village side, Holmesfield. We were playing at Stocksbridge, and I was out in the middle, and I looked across, and I saw the Jamie Vardy stand at Stock because it just made me giggle. It made me giggle because it's one of those. It's a part of the story that makes it real for me. If you look at Jamie Vardy's story in isolation, it is incredible, yeah. Really, to say what he's done, what he's still doing now at 37, you know, and he's still a talisman for them. His work rate and his desire is still there. Massive. Mm. You know, whether he is a, it doesn't matter whether he's at his pomp anymore. He's still a very capable player. He scored what turned out to be the winner at the weekend. But, you know, it's nice to have played some part in his story, you know, as lots of people have. You know, the coaches who have worked with him have all played important roles. And I think it's, you know, the staff who work with him to make him into an athlete, you know, whether it be the physios or whether it be the sports science staff, have actually educated somebody who is, or you don't want him to not be a rough diamond anymore. That's a part of what he is. He is a scoundrel in some ways, but he's a
likeable.
He's
scoundrel.
A really yeah. top scoundrel. I love him. I do. I love him because of he is what he is. He yeah. is what he is, and he's been successful because he is him. And that's in the modern world where there's a lot of pressure on young people to be what other people want you to be. You know.
True.
You've got your own children, you see it, how it affects them, you know, peer pressure, etc. For somebody to succeed and still be very much visibly, not only behind the scenes, but visibly, he is what he is, and that's the beauty of him. And he's a bloody good player as well.
Well, he says that you saved his career at Leicester, so the love is mutual, clearly.
Well, I saved his career. I don't know whether I did. I know Craig Shakespeare, who, you know, Shakey not only is a good coach, but a great foil for me as well. You know, I worked with him. It was nice to catch up with him at Watford. So, you know, when you get sacked as a manager, sometimes, it happens out of the blue. The staff stayed there, and it was, you know, it was fantastic for them what happened after that. But, you know, sometimes you don't get a chance to really show your appreciation of the people that you work with, because they allow you to be yourself as well. And I think that's really important as a manager, that you have people who create a foil for you and are different to you. You don't want nodding dogs around you. I don't, anyway. I don't want people who are just going to say agree the same thing. I don't. Yeah, yeah. I want people who are going to challenge me and tell me I'm wrong. If you ask Shaky about it, he'd probably say he had to choose his moments sometimes, because I could be bloody awkward. And
Can't we all?
Yeah, exactly. And but it was really good to work with him at Watford because we both changed massively. You don't realise, I don't think, at times how much you do change over the years. And people still have this. People like to pigeonhole you, and people tell me what I am, and which is fine. And I'm probably responsible for creating an image to keep people at arm's length as much as anything. You know, I have a reputation of being a miserable bugger who, you know, is always moaning. That's not the case at all. I can verify that. Humor's a big part of life and work environment.
Yeah.
Especially in football.
Yeah, absolutely.
So in private, are you completely opposite?
No, I think if you ask Nikki, my wife, she'd say, yeah, he's still miserable.
A couple of beers, he's all right.
Yeah, I'm all right. I'm all right after a couple of drinks, yeah. But, I think because the game's at the top end as well is so intrusive and, you know, there's a lot of interest, there's a lot of exposure, I think at times you've got to protect a part of you that you know you can't always be in the public domain and let everybody see exactly what you are. Well, that's my way of dealing with it anyway. I mean, people would, if I talk about Watford, people would say, oh yeah, you must have, you know, can't like Gino Pozzo. I actually quite like Gino, actually, and I got on well with the technical director, who was very helpful, but you have to understand that there are, each club has its own dynamics, and so I knew when I went in there it wasn't going to be necessarily a long gig for me, because just the history of it, and I think that, generally speaking, there is a preference for foreign coaches rather than somebody who is a manager. But look, I don't have anything really. I mean, I was upset how I was sacked, but it's more about the how and the timing of it. But I mean, I got on really well with my colleagues who were, if you like, seen as being above me, you know, and we had a very good working relationship. I had nothing to do with recruitment, but I knew that from the outset because
I got interviews for that job and I didn't take it. Like, I mean,
but I was going.
I'm not sure they were going to offer it to me, to be fair. But
no. Sam, I took it because I'd been in Belgium, I'd come back, I was out of work, and it just
great job.
It's a great job.
Yeah, it is. Yeah,
it's
definitely
a great job.
Yeah,
and I enjoyed my time there, and it was I still laugh about it now, and I tell everybody, you know, COVID got me 3 months more money because, you know, there was a break in the season.
Yeah,
I would have probably been sacked in May.
Yeah,
you know, it's just one of those things where you have to be realistic about the situation that you're going to. And I agree with Sam that you have to understand the situation that you're going into. So every club will be different. My time at Hull City, I mean, Adam Pearson was brilliant. He was, I mean, what was his job title? I don't really remember, but he was basically, he operated like a director of football. He probably was a CEO. He was very good for us as a group of staff. For Steve Walsh, he was head of recruitment. You know, there was a realism. We got an embargo, a transfer embargo. So you've got to be creative. You've got to try and find ways of still looking to shape a squad. And he was, what I learned from Adam in lots of ways was he was solution based. He was always, you know, he would be straight in terms of saying, no, you can't do that.
Yeah.
But then he'd say, but what about this? So we give you an alternative.
Yeah. Find it, a way around it. Yeah,
it wasn't
new,
always
new,
a flat
yeah,
no.
A
it,
approach,
was,
yeah.
it was a it was a it was a constructive no,
yeah.
if you like. But that gives you, you know, you don't feel as though you're against a brick wall. Where I've worked with other people where it, you know, whatever you sort of suggest, you almost feel before you get the no that there's going to be, it's on their terms and they want what they want and they're going to get what they want because it's their club, or, you know, that they don't really have a respect for what you bring, and they don't really understand what you bring. You know, when I was at Derby as well, I mean, Mel Morris, I think both of us would probably admit that
clashed.
We shouldn't have really
been together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean I don't, you know, I don't like him as a bloke or whatever. It doesn't really matter. I just think it was a situation that we both made a mistake of going into.
Yeah.
You know, Derby's a fantastic club with an incredible fan base,
yeah.
you know, and who have stayed loyal and really backed their team under any circumstances. Yeah. You know, it's a super club. But
and he put a massive amount of money into
he
that.
He did. He did.
I mean, he might have been a difficult, I don't know how difficult, I heard how difficult he was by some managers that have been before you and after you.
Yeah.
But you can't argue with the fact that he put his money where his mouth is.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You know, I know how many times they get in the playoffs and not quite make it.
I know.
It was quite strange for Derby, wasn't it?
Yeah. The fans at Derby are brilliant. And that makes me think about the fans at Sheffield Wednesday from the weekend as well. Did you see how many fans they had? Was it 7,500 yeah. they took up to Blackburn?
I mean, I played for them. I signed there in the late 80s and into the early 90s. And I was a part of a team that was, you know, pretty successful under Ron Atkinson.
Big Ron.
And then
Trev took
over.
Yeah.
You know, and we had a European campaign, which was brilliant. I think the one season we were, I think it was Ron's last season there. We were in with a shout with 2 weeks to go of even winning what would be the Premier League now, but it's Division One back then.
Was there a huge fan base then as well?
Oh, massive. Yeah. Honestly, yeah. You know, to play at Hillsborough with...
It's that
you
weird
know,
slope though, isn't it? It's
yeah.
Like that,
yeah, they've sort of...
I hated it. Like, right? I mean, have they yeah, now? No, I mean, you I go know. There... Honest to God, and it's mental.
But the
this,
cop but there, the, you look, the cop there, honest, like,
we're playing uphill here.
It goes on forever.
And, you know what I mean?
And when you play in front of that, because yeah. it's a traditional ground, but when it's full, wow.
Yeah.
You know, it's got its own charm. And I think the Wednesday fans are, to generalise, I think it's difficult to generalise about fan bases and be accurate, but I think they are pretty positive as a fan base, you know, and even in difficult times, they'd still be getting 17,000-18,000, you know, and I mean, I don't know, I don't know what their average will be this year, but I think since Danny's been in there, they're giving themselves a chance, which you just wouldn't expect from the start of the season. Chris Powell, friend of mine, who played for me as well at Leicester towards the end of his career and became a player coach, he's on the staff there. And I think he'll be really important as a sounding board, as a more senior head for Danny. And he's what's effectively his first job. But I hear some fantastic things about his ability as a coach. You know,
who's
Danny Rill?
All right, okay,
yeah, 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 Very good. Lots of really good things about him. I think he's done a really, really good job to
outside the relegation zone. I know. For the first time since August.
Yeah, but
what a time.
Yeah, but that's not the job done, is it? And that's the danger of getting into that sort of a situation.
I have no sympathy for them whatsoever on what they did to the previous manager that they sacked. So, you know, I mean,
for the way they got up through the playoffs. Yeah.
Telling him we were going after the game when they lost at Peterborough, I believe, and then saying you won't be here next year, and then even turning it around and getting promoted, and then and then sacking him just didn't lie. Didn't lie well with me. Unless it was something more sinister than that, and nobody's told me that that's the case.
It wasn't, because
you know what I mean,
I spoke to Morrow.
Yeah,
and it's you know.
Shouldn't have happened.
It was sad. But again, it's an owner with a
ego.
There you go.
And another one that likes to release statements. I remember that statement earlier in the season. That was a weird one. They are out of the relegation zone as it stands, but they've got West Brom at home and Sunderland away.
Yeah.
Probably, do they need to win both, would they, do you think?
They probably need one win, minimum. Yeah. Do you think they can do it?
Oh, I think they will.
Mm. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think there's the Championship this year, it's, you know, the automatic places. What a race that is! But the relegation places—it's the smallest middle of the table. I've seen for years.
You know.
Normally, you get that group of teams in the middle that
three
you think,
leagues, isn't it? Normally,
yeah.
Where bottom, the middle, and the top, right? But no,
the tails along. You know, in cricket, they'd say that you know it's a tail that can wag. It has been over the last month or so. It's been a. Teams have been sucked into it. Teams have struggled to get away from it. You know, the promotion places are. I mean, the playoffs. There's less sides who can probably break into that now. But it's there's interest in right the way through.
Really?
Right the way through the league. It's a fascinating division, and it's very very tough to be successful in.
Yeah, I just love the Championship. I can't wait to watch the end of the Championship season at both ends to see what's going on. A couple of other things that have been going on lately in football. With two managers here, I'd like to get your take on De Zerbi at Brighton, because he is being linked, as he seems to be all the time, to various other jobs. Obviously, Brighton have had a little dip in form. I'm hoping it continues because they play Manchester City on Thursday away. but where do you think De Zerbi will be next season?
Brighton.
Yeah.
I think so, yeah.
Okay.
That was...
Thank you. That's fine.
I don't see that he's wanted
an extended answer, and for once you've got...
Let me say this. He'll be very, very lucky. He'll be very lucky if he gets one of the top jobs just yet, because he's taken over from an outstanding football club, Graham Potter.
Mm.
He did an outstanding job along with, but the owner's the best man. He's structured that football club to be a massive success on a limited budget, makes huge amounts of money by finding players and then selling them on, which finances the football club to be what it is and to help the manager be as successful as he is. And he's carried on where Graham Potter left off. What has improved is the number of goals they scored.
Mm.
Now, they score more goals. Before, they used to create just as many chances as they create now, but couldn't, for some reason, put them in the back of the net.
Mm.
And so, he's getting good publicity. And if he does get the opportunity to get a better job, he should take it.
Yeah.
And snatch their hands off as quick as they can, because if he doesn't take it now, he might never get the opportunity again while he's held in I esteem.
Sometimes on the podcast, we like to do is it true? Because we hear things about our guests and we think the best way to find out if it's true is just to ask you.
Correct.
So, Leicester were actually scouting. Is it true? Leicester were actually scouting Riyad Mahrez's teammate before spotting him and signing the winger.
No idea. Yeah, the reason I say no idea, my role in terms of being involved in the recruitment process is I'm a filter, like, but an important filter. So I only get involved right at the end of it. So, you know, it's not something that I'm not somebody who talks about I signed or I don't do that. I'm a part of a team. It may be the case that we were looking at somebody else and then Mara's cropped up. I can tell you a little story about that though. And that was, he was playing on a Friday night. I was due to go out with Steve Walsh and Rob McKenzie, Rob who's now at Spurs. We were playing QPR the next day, and it was an earlier kickoff. So I, in the end, couldn't risk going to France to watch the game. But what I did say is, look, if you both go and you both come back and say,
yes,
we're going to sign, yes, I'll
go with it.
I'll go with it. So, you know, that's my involvement in that one. And I'd seen the clips. I hadn't seen him live. And it was just very, very straightforward. And on, for that amount of money, as it was, I think it was about 380 grand, maybe, is what it was.
Yeah.
You know, I can afford to go to the board and push it. You know, that sounds peanuts, doesn't it? Now, in real terms, but you know that was how that story went. And you've got to, if you've got the right people in the right positions, it's not always about you. It's about, we're looking for a certain player for a certain position, and the style of player, the type of player is this. The profile of the player is this. That's what we're looking for.
And you had some pretty good players, didn't you, over that time? You recruited some really good players,
But Sam, we had some successes, but we also had a few duffers.
Oh, well, Dave, but you don't mention them, though, do you?
Yeah, but
I didn't anyway.
No.
You know what I mean? Anybody that asked me, I mean, I'd avoid the question and move on to someone else very quickly.
But we all signed one or two duffers, but your successes.
Mario Jardel was one of the biggest duffers I ever signed. But
but your successes.
Yes.
Outshine them.
Absolutely.
And that's the big thing about it. And how do you spend money? Well, look, if you've got a brain about you, you've got to be aware of what the club's needs are. Yeah, it's as a manager, yeah, you've got to look after your own position. You've got to try and buy it. You're always trying to buy yourself time, more time to be more successful. Mm-hmm. And the best way of doing that, of course, is to succeed, and success can either be like winning games is the big one, of course it is, but then you've got to be able to, you know, you bring players through, you there's lots of different factors that can help buy you time. Mm-hmm. Having a good contract can be one of them as well, because it means that it's harder to sack you. Mm-hmm. You know, but there's lots of things
like Steve Walsh was somebody that
well, you took Steve to
Newcastle.
To Newcastle. That's where I met him.
Steve had worked for Chelsea as a school teacher, you know, and Steve had worked for Chelsea part time for many years, like in the Northwest.
Yeah.
And his brother, younger brother, is Mick Walsh, who played for Blackpool QPR, was a very successful centre forward, wasn't he? And I got over the years and years seen Steve in the stand and spoke to him. And so when I was looking for a chief scout at Newcastle to restructure Newcastle's problems to overcome in the short and long term, was to employ Walshy for the first time as his full-time job. So Brian Robson recommended Nige to stay on. When I rang him, I said, what about Nige? He said, well, he's great. He'll be great for you. Like, so that was enough for me. So, and it was then up to Nigel whether he wanted to stay or not. And I said, but we met all in that short period of time. And then obviously Nigel liked what he saw. So Steve ends up going with Nigel and they have a great success at Hull and Leicester.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So then I bump into Walshy again when I get Everton job because he's got director of football position at Everton, like you mean. So it's amazing how our paths end up crossing over in the beginning. And where it all started was, you know, Walshy, do you want to be head of recruitment at Newcastle? Yeah. It's a big risk for him.
Yeah.
Because you never know how long you're going to last even in that job, like you mean.
Small world football.
So it's a small world, you know.
Just a couple more. With the season drawing to a close, one of the most memorable final day moments is Jimmy Glass scoring for Carlisle in 1999 to keep them up.
Might be memorable.
best ever signing?
Wow. Well, do you know something? He's got to be up there. Because Michael Knighton. No, but he rang me actually a few. I'll waffle a little bit here. Okay. He rang me. He got back in touch. And again, somebody who, I mean, he sold Tony Cagg to Blackpool on deadline day for, I think, 5 or 10 grand. So we ain't got a keeper. So I'm glad Jimmy came because we hadn't got anybody else. We got one other keeper who needed a backup. So, yeah, I mean, it was, and Jimmy was prepared to come. He was at Swindon, I think, at the time. Mm-hmm. And he'd not played any games. So, you know, it was a big risk for us as a club. It was a big risk for him. But... wow, he'll be remembered for scoring a goal. And it's just a crazy story. And I sometimes sort of consider what may have happened to my career after that.
Yeah.
Had we gone down which probably we should have done. Scarborough would, I mean, I remember the scenes. I remember seeing the pictures that had been shown on Sky with the Scarborough fans celebrating because our game was delayed because there was a leg break in the first half. So one of the Plymouth players, there you go, Plymouth, you know. And so we were about 7 or 8 minutes behind the rest of the...
Did you send him up or did he just go up himself? Did you just go on, get up there?
He looked over to me.
They look over the bench, don't they?
He looked over to me like a Labrador, like, you know. he'd have gone anyway.
Yeah, why not?
I mean, I can't take credit for it. I may have gone, go on there. Yeah. I don't know. I can't remember.
Yeah.
Anyway, he went up and he scored. And
it's one of the best things in football.
And a great finish as well. I mean, yeah, probably couldn't miss from there, but you know, it's an incredible story. But as with every story, there's an upside for us, and you know, it was something that happened out of, you know, you couldn't plan for that. And
he was a case, Michael Knight, wasn't he? I mean, he was this far away
from getting Man United.
Buying Man United.
Oh,
you're not remembering juggling
the ball on the pitch.
No, it's too young.
Yeah, honest to God.
He went on there in full kit.
He was searching around for whatever they needed, the first payment. And he was searching around. And I don't know how true this was, but like Owen Oyston, I was at Blackpool at the time, manager. Owen Oyston said that he'd sort of tried to find the money he needed to get to buy the football club and asked Owen Oyston if he was interested in taking a share of Man United, if he lent him that money. And clearly, Owen Oyston said no. But he must have gone to a number of people like that to try and raise I think it was only about 10 million to get control of the club. And he couldn't do it.
Mm.
And he fell by the wayside. But I don't know, he ran private schools or something like that, I think, was it?
How random.
I think so.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think so.
But it was an interesting case going from juggling the ball on Old Trafford to buying Carlisle United Football Club. Yeah. You know?
I'm going to Google it.
Yeah. Don't you. Sack me. My first, yeah, but my first experience. Yeah. And, yeah. And you know, you've got to get used to it. It happens.
Right. Two questions left for you. We had quite a few people message us about Alex Scott.
Yeah.
How good, how far can he go?
He's a real talent. He's got a great temperament as well. But I'm surprised that people don't ask the question about Antoine Semenya, because I think he's a modern, he's fabulous. And I think when you look at those two players, when you lose players of that quality, so obviously yeah, they've both gone to Bournemouth, and you know, have settled into the Premier League pretty well. But Antoine's natural pace and power is incredible. But they've both got, I think they've both got bright futures because they're able to deal with the situation as well as being good enough technically. Technically, they're, you know, like I say, Antoine's biggest strength is his physicality and his pace, power. Alex Scott is a really good technician, and I think will get better because he's got a really good brain too. He's an intelligent player, but like I say, they've got good temperament, so they've both got a great chance.
Now, last question, and we had a lot of people message us about this, and I have purposely not Googled it, so I know nothing. I'm going to ask it because I really want your reaction. A lot of people messaged us wanting me to ask you about a pack of wolves. What is the story there?
Yeah, pack of wolves, no. But it was, it's the story about in Romania. It's me walking on a walking holiday in Transylvania and in the Carpathian Mountains. I'd done some research.
On your own?
On my own, yeah. I'd done some research.
It's always a bit weird that way, like, you know, you go off on his own and do a lot of
Transylvania.
Walking.
Yeah,
Transylvania.
Yeah, as you do. I just packed a bag, got on a train in Sheffield and got a train basically to a place called Brasov.
Okay.
In the Carpathian Mountains, which sounds a bit odd, but I went via...
Was that planned or was it...
No.
Well,
I wanted to go there.
That way, yeah.
I wanted to go there.
Yeah.
But I just sort of jumped on a train and it went from there, really. So
wow.
Got a sleeper to from Paris to Munich. Spent a couple of days there, which was, yeah, interesting. Bit of beer.
I like the beer.
Yeah. And shared a sleeper going to Romania with about a 75-year-old woman. I didn't speak any Romanian. She couldn't speak any English, but yeah, we had a good journey together.
Had a good chat.
It was interesting. I'd done some reading up on the dangers because, you know, there are bears and wolves and all sorts in still. But what the shepherds do for the summer pastures is they always leave dogs with the sheep to look after the flock because to keep the predators at bay. And I got attacked by three dogs to start with, and they attack you in a pack. So one will go for you and the others will go around the back. They'll try and get you off your guard. And basically what they do is they get you by your neck. So I shit myself basically.
I'm sure you did.
It was, I still get, you know, I'm talking about it now. I still can feel the
panic.
It was because sure. I was.
So you managed to fight them off, then, did you?
Yeah, I got a walking pole and I ended up, I mean, I blinded one, I presume. I stuck it, good. You know. But they came back for me, actually, about a kilometre further up the hill. Once I'd got rid of them.
Yeah.
Really?
I fought them off.
They came back again?
The shepherd actually recalled them in the end. And they went back, and he must have seen that I'd given one a pretty nasty wound. So whether he sent them back after me, I don't know. But anyway, the second time they attacked, I was able to back myself against a tree. And I'd read in this walking book about it that, you know, if you do get attacked by them, to if you can back yourself against something, you've got a better chance of surviving, but also get some rocks and throw. So the second time they came, I was target practice with rocks, lobbing rocks at them. And it must have, the second, you know, the two attacks, the first one would, it felt like an hour, but it was probably only about 5 or 10 minutes. The second one was a bit longer, maybe 15, 20 minutes.
Did they run away?
Huh?
Did they just run away at the end?
They backed off in the end. Yeah.
Why did they attack you? I've got so many questions. Were you near the flock of sheep?
I wasn't aware as I was near them. But then I hitchhiked a lift back down. I absolutely had lost all desire to keep walking on that day. So
I'm sure, yeah.
So
I ended up to stay there and go back home.
But there was a guy on he got a horse drawn cart, and he'd been in the mountains collecting firewood up into the there's like a tree line just below the rocks, and he'd been collecting wood, and I basically with a very I must have looked very upset. He allowed me to sit on his wagon, and I got a lift back to the nearest town, which took about 3 hours, I think.
Wow. I'm so glad I didn't Google that in advance.
Yeah. I was the brakeman, actually, on the way down. So, because it was quite a steep track, and it was just a two-wheeled cart. And he got me to basically put a chain through both wheels and hold it so that the wheels would skid to slow it down going down the hill. So it was all in all, it was a pretty
dramatic.
Yeah, it was an interesting day. Mm. I think by the time I got back, I've got some good photos of that day, actually, because I actually hitchhiked a lift in a car with this. I mean, I'd never heard of them then, but they're popular here now, Dacias. But this must have been a 1970s Dacia. I got a lift in with this.
Been a good documentary this year, hasn't it?
This
Trials and Tribulations of Nigel Pearson, who rode. And
he's bloke and two
walking,
women gave me
he's walking, yeah.
Yeah, gave me a lift to the bottom of the track. And then I got a lift back in a horse and cart. I drank a few pints as soon as I got back, by the way.
Wow. You did.
Wow. I can't remember the name of the place now. I think it was something like Zanesti. It's quite near. Where Dracula's castle is. It's not too far away, near Bram. Yeah.
Thank you to everybody that sent that question in, because I feel like I wouldn't have asked that, Sam.
But you know,
so,
I still Brilliant. Feel cheated now, because it's the ridges up there are just brilliant. It's limestone. It's a bit like I suppose it's a bit like the Dolomites in Italy. So maybe I'll go back if I become fit enough to do it again. I won't.
I won't go back. That's the mic drop for the end of the podcast. Nigel Pearson, thank you so much
Nigel.
For coming to see us.
Pleasure.
Incredibly interesting.
It's
as
been amazing.
Always. Thank you.
Sam, thank you very much.
Pleasure.
So we will be back next week with another episode of No Tippy Tappy Football, brought to you by William Hill.
Keep subscribing.
Keep subscribing.